You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the course of the Civil War from 1861 to 1865, an estimated 750,000 people were killed, nearly 2.5% of the country's population. Rick Burns examines how this massive death toll transformed the nation in his latest documentary, Death in the Civil War, based on the book by historian Drew Faust. It premieres tonight at 8 p.m. on PBS, a day after the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Antietam, which remains the single bloodiest day in American history. I'm very pleased to welcome Rick Burns back to our show. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Why is the Civil War known as the first modern war? Was it so much more deadly than previous wars?
It was significantly more deadly, exponentially more deadly, and that had to do with a number of factors. One was the size of the armies. These weren't small professional armies, for example, along the lines of what it fought when America fought the Mexicans in the Mexican-American War, 1846 to 48, the war before the Civil War. This was mass citizen armies totaling about 3 million, 2.1 million in the North, 850,000 in the South. So it was the sheer number and size of the armies that were colliding. It was also, of course, the technology, the modern technology that got them rapidly to the battlefield, often by train and increasingly so as the war wore on, that supplied them and resupplied them so that engagements, campaigns could last longer and the mayhem and the engagements could continue over battle after battle. It was a war fought with weapons technology way ahead of the tactics, principally with respect to the rifled musket, kind of a simple innovation that throws a bullet with a spiral on it, like a quarterback throwing a pass, and with comparable accuracy, so that those weapons were simply much more lethal, up to 500 yards and more, as compared to the old smoothbore muskets. But the tactics were still mass your men and mass your fire.
Still,
on top of everything else, there was the disease factor. These are rural boys, especially from the South, crowded into huge camps with each other. No germ theory of disease, no real understanding of the way infection worked, and therefore two out of three of the people, of the men who died in the Civil War, died of disease.
And there was nothing in place when the war began, no military cemeteries or hospitals, no national records of who died and where, no method for notifying families or returning bodies home. How had those things been handled in previous wars like the War of 1812 and the Mexican-American War?
The numbers were so relatively small that it was still something that could be handled by family, clan, kin, brother officers could take care of it. And death was, by and large, intensely a matter of family and kinship. But so we just have to imagine a time when it was literally inconceivable that you could have deaths on this scale. I mean, in 12 hours at the first Battle of Bull Run, the first biggish battle of the war, seemed huge in 61, seemed trivial later. You know, 900,000 men died on the battlefield in 12 hours. That was half the battlefield deaths of the entire Mexican War, which had sprawled across 2 years. And it gives you some sense of the exponential increase in lethality that warfare had achieved just in a 12, 13-year period since the end of the Mexican War.
When the war began, were people prepared for it to be as drawn out and bloody as it turned out to be? Didn't most of the men in both the North and the South enlist thinking that it would be over in a year or two?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Lincoln called for a 90-day enlistment. It was assumed that on each side strongly that the Union would have no stomach for a shooting war to bring back its, quote, erring sister, the South. The North, in turn, thought that with its superiority, the kind of the impertinent belligerence of the South would be abruptly curtailed, and that one Southern senator guaranteed he would drink all the blood that was spilled in the war, meaning it was assumed widely that there would be very little, if any, blood shed, and it would be over very quickly. What they discovered was that the genie of war, once having been let out of the bottle, not only took on a life of its own, but it took on a life of its own in a context in which the world was changing from kind of a smaller, more rural 18th century world to a world that was pretty soon going to look more like our 20th century world. And in many ways, the Civil War anticipated and precursed the death tolls of the First World War.
Well, weren't there wars going on in Europe and Asia as well? Were they similar, or was the Civil War, as you say, more technologically advanced and therefore more deadly?
I mean, it's right to remember the Taiping Rebellion was one that was bringing deaths on an even greater scale. But one also has to remember that the populations were exponentially larger in China at the time. There was really no comparable European war, though there were wars that were going on. What was really new about the American War, Civil War, was the size of those armies and their susceptibility to disease and their and the increase of the technology of the rifled musket. Those things turned out to be what the historian David Hacker has put has described as a kind of a perfect storm. 20 years before, you wouldn't have had those kind of casualties and deaths. 20 years later, the beginning of a understanding of the germ theory of disease, ability to treat, understanding of sepsis would have allowed much, much more expeditious and effective handling of the wounded.
Now, there were no dog tags, so obviously no DNA identifiers.
No.
So how would dead soldiers identify during the Civil War, and were the approaches similar in the North and the South?
They were similar and a little bit different at the same time, North and South. I mean, we have to understand there's simply no method, no system in place, North or South, for tracking the timeline of an individual soldier. It was, just wasn't assumed that you would need to do so. And therefore, there were no dog tags. There was no kind of systematic enlistment records, no following a soldier from enlistment to mustering out or, sadly, to the grave. What that meant was that when the battles took place, and we have to remember that these battles grew in size and deadliness as the war went on, so that by 62 they were worse than 61, and 63 worse again, and 64 was the bloodiest single year of the war. And what would happen would be newspapers, private communications agencies like newspapers, would glean what military releases there were, and those military records issued by the War Department were really kept and released on a purely military basis. And so you would look through, you know, the local morning paper, the Chattanooga Times, the New York Herald Tribune, any newspaper you could to see the casualties from First Bull Run or Malvern Hill or Antietam or Gettysburg and hope that you didn't see a loved one's name. And even if you did or didn't, it was no sign that you had any sure information about what was going on. So every battle, especially the big ones, kind of spurred this cascade of general public anxiety. Where's my son? Where's my brother? Where's my husband? Where's my father? And those were questions that were not being answered by the federal government, but by the person who was fighting next to you who might or might not have known you on the line at Second Bull Run. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I saw your son last. Or it might be new voluntary private organizations like the U.S. Sanitary Commission in the North or the U.S. Christian Commission, comparable agencies in the South, but not quite comparable. From the beginning, the South is hampered by far fewer resources, far less money, a much weaker communications function for getting the news back home, even in an ad hoc and improvised and private way, so that it was, if anything, even worse in the South, even as with most of the battles being fought in the South, except, you know, significantly Antietam and Gettysburg, you had this horrific statistic, 1 in 5 white men of military age, 18 to 45, died in the war. Every family.
And the statistics were, proportions were even higher for black soldiers.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we think of death as a constant, and in some ways it is. In certain ways it also, there are changes and discontinuities in the experience of death, and there was a big one between blacks and whites in the war. Obviously, enslaved Americans were on a far more intimate footing with death to begin with. You could be killed you know, peremptorily by your slave master. Nutrition was terrible. But once the war began and the fighting began, and finally by 63, black troops were put into the field on the northern side. They were never treated they were never taken prisoner. They were executed as slaves engaged in an uprising. So basically, you had a kind of a very stark set of circumstances for black Americans who were in the U.S. Army, who were frequently given not only the worst tasks, burying the dead, but the most dangerous assignments, which we know famously from the movie Glory, the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, led by Robert Gould Shaw in South Carolina at Battery Wagner. So there were just, it was really a kind of a black and white circumstance for African Americans. But in general, what one takes away from the war, in a way that was, I think, different from the way my brother Ken and I took away from the war, was simply a society, North and South, unprepared for the sort of the tidal wave of death that was unleashed. And in a funny way, trying to find in real time, always more than one step behind, some way from the most intimate psychic level to the broadest national levels, some way to compensate, improvise, find a new way to deal with what Drew Faust, on whose book our film is based, The Work of Death in the Civil War, which turned out to be a transforming job indeed.
You include very moving letters written by dying soldiers, and there's one written by a man on the battlefield. He began writing it before he was injured and then finished it as he lay dying. Where did those letters come from?
You know, it's been fun having the president of Harvard, Drew Faust, as my research assistant as going through this project. It's made it a lot easier, I can tell you. And I have a bottomless admiration and gratitude for her book and for her help making the film. And Drew, while we went to many, many archives, and there were very few in which Drew Faust wasn't there ahead of us, one very prominent one was the Massachusetts Historical Society, where the papers of Henry Bowditch, a New York, Boston doctor whose son died in the spring of 63, and the story of whose grief forms a very central strand in our story. Also an amazing letter from a lieutenant colonel of the 2nd Massachusetts Infantry, Wilder Dwight, Lieutenant Colonel Wilder Dwight, who described, you know, in a way, we have to remember, Leonard, you and I are talking the day after the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Antietam, which was yesterday. And there on what Wilder Dwight called a misty, moisty morning, he's there on his horse in part of the reserves, the Massachusetts, 2nd Massachusetts was being held back, writing to his mother from his saddle, "Dear Mother, Sharpsburg, Maryland, where Antietam was fought." Describing how Hooker's men had charged in and were giving the Confederates what for, and that he was doing very well and was safe, at least at that time. And then the moment the letter breaks off, and the handwriting changes abruptly and alarmingly, and in a kind of a spidery, faltering, and increasingly illegible script, he describes having been wounded in such a way as to have been rendered helpless. He asks his mother to say goodbye to his beloved father and brothers. He notes that his troops have left the field where he lies, and then finally simply signs off, you know, "Dearest Mother Wilder, all is well with those who have faith."
Well, we said earlier that the Battle of Antietam was the bloodiest day in the history of the United States.
Unthinkable.
How many people died, and what happened in that fight? Was that a turning point for the North?
It was absolutely the turning point in the war. James McPherson, the great Civil War historian at Princeton, has said it was more transformations were set into motion by Antietam. Just one day, indeed, to be sure, the bloodiest single day of the war, 22,000 casualties, 7,000 plus dead. The numbers depend on where you put the goalposts of death, but simply astonishing. Begins at 6, over by nightfall. I mean, there were places in the center of the line where there were, you know, sort of a place called the Sunken Road, a kind of a gentle sunken farm road, known thereafter as Bloody Lane, where sort of bodies were stacked up by like cordwood. Everything was at stake for both sides.
The
Union Army had been beaten again and again by Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson. The South was on the verge of persuading Britain and France to recognize the legitimacy of its seceded government, which would have spelled disaster for the Union cause. And so men on both sides fought for the first time now on Union soil, right across from Virginia and beautiful Maryland farmland, fought with a particular fury. McPherson called it a super adrenalized fury, sort of heedless of the normal instincts of self-preservation. And what happened was that because McClellan, the Union general who could have won the day, could have followed up battlefield tactical advantages and never did, McClellan never did throughout the war follow up any advantage he had, always misestimated the size of the army he was facing. Nevertheless, it was a strategic victory for the Union. Lee retreated and ended that first invasion of northern soil. And all those bodies stacked up in Antietam, and they lay rotting for days and days because there were no burial, you know, no systematic techniques for burying, really was a pivot point. It gave Abraham Lincoln the marginal victory he needed to issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which came out on January 1st. Now, suddenly, this wasn't a war about Union and states' rights, which, of course, it had never been, but it was a war about the meaning of freedom in America, about the definition of citizenship, and England and France were not going to intervene in that kind of warfare. So death spurred not only tremendous changes in the way people approach their own mortality, the way they sought to get themselves buried or have loved ones buried, but it precipitated changes on the in military tactics, changes in policy, changes in the very definition of what constituted our notion of the state and the government.
And because it was photography, Matthew Brady took some of his most famous photographs of those bodies lying on the battlefield. The public developed a different idea of what war was all about, didn't it?
No, it was yet another way that Antietam was a turning point. There, a couple days after the battle, are these civilians. I mean, imagine this today. Civilians on the battlefield in the aftermath with hundreds, perhaps thousands, of unburied, sort of putrefying bodies, most of them by that time Confederate. These guys are Alexander Gardner and his colleagues sent out by Matthew Brady from New York to take photographs. A series of photographs which became, 2 months later, a very, very famous and high-impact exhibit down at Lower Broadway in Brady's Daguerrean Gallery, The Dead at Antietam. And now, in a huge way, George Will puts it so succinctly in our film, in the blink of an eye, the relationship between the home front and the war and the front lines changed forever. And people in the North particularly, who had been remote from most of the action, now could see this is what war is.
How did the massive death toll affect the country when it was all over? What kind of military systems for dealing with death were in place after the war ended that hadn't existed before? And one more thing, because we're pretty much out of time, is this where many of our notions about how military death should be honored in this country come from?
It's where all our notions about how military death should be honored come from. I mean, you have to imagine more, you know, half of the dead, half of those 750,000 are never identified. When the war is over, when after Appomattox and Durham, the South is a kind of a Golgotha, an open gravesite across 1,000 miles with hundreds of thousands of unburied, scarcely buried bodies, bodies buried in mass graves, half of them unidentified. And in the immediate months after the war, the Union Army began, the Quartermaster General's office, began to devise a means, realized they had to survey the extent of the lethality. Who was out there? Where were they buried? Were the graves that could be left as is, or would there have to be some large, massive reinterment program? And by 1866, 1867, it was clear as a result of those surveys, the size of the undertaking was such that the federal government would have to take it up. And the largest public works project to that day was put in motion, the equivalent in today's dollars of $75 million, to rebury the dead, the Union dead only, in national, safe, protected national cemeteries. And that began the sense that all Americans have, which is that we will not rest until every MIA is found, until everybody is buried, until every family member is notified, until those people, those men, and now women as well, are put to rest and sort of under the explicit understanding that their sacrifice to their country will never be forgotten.
Rick Burns' film, Death in the Civil War, premieres at 8 p.m. tonight on PBS as part of the American Experience series. Rick, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much, Leonard. All the best.